Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin in a moment and go to Cairo, Egypt for an update on the aftermath of the revolution as exuberant and exhausted young Egyptians return to classes with the military firmly in control of a country they have ruled since independence. Sheila Carapico, the chair of the Political Science Department at the American University in Cairo, joins us. Then we'll talk about Yemen, a country that many analysts feel could be the next to go the way of Tunisia and Egypt. Charles Schmitz, the president of the American Institute of Yemeni Studies, joins us. Then finally, we'll talk with NPR's Deborah Amos, who is in Saudi Arabia. She covers the Middle East for National Public Radio and did a very prescient broadcast back in November featuring Egyptian youth using social media to push for political change. Let's now go to Cairo, Egypt. I'm speaking with Sheila Carapico, who's the chair of the Political Science Department at the American University in Cairo, where she researches the political economy of development with special emphasis on Arab countries. She's the author of Civil Society in Yemen, The Political Economy of Activism in Modern Arabia, and her forthcoming book is titled Political Aid, Democracy's Promotion, and the Paradoxes of Empowerment. She's also a contributing editor to Middle East Report. And I imagine you, Sheila, in Cairo there, along with all of the Egyptians in that city and throughout that country, are, elated and exhausted at the same time?
Yeah, I would say that summarizes it pretty well. There's still a lot of jubilation. The word on everyone's mouth is Mabruk, which means congratulations. And but at the same time, yeah, we're tired and, you know, also facing, not me personally, but, people around me facing huge challenges in the days and weeks and months to come.
Well, we spoke on the first day, and this has been about, 20 days, the 20 days that shook the world?
Yep.
And just towards the end there, it was almost unbelievable, the non-resignation. So I imagine people's emotions were whipsawed. Where's the sort of feeling now of both accomplishment and wariness? I would think that now the military are in charge, and let's face it, the military have always been in charge since the colonial British.
Yeah, precisely. I mean, you know, as I'm sure you've watched and talked about already, you know, there was great kind of despondency and disappointment on Friday morning, and then Friday evening, it was, you know, about 6 in the evening or something like that, around sundown, when, you know, the announcement that the president was leaving came out, and, I mean, the outpouring into the streets was just, I mean, I'm sure, you know, world historic, just unbelievable. And I myself was just moved to tears repeatedly. And a lot of people are still retaining that sense of euphoria. I mean, I went to, you know, we had started classes today at the American University, and, you know, most people from the janitors to the president are just and the students, of course, remain quite elated. But yeah, it is, and I almost hesitate, you know, to then turn to the negative side of it, because I think that regardless of what does happen in the future, I mean, a point has been made and something has been proven that can never, ever be taken back, which is that, you know, if enough people take to the streets with enough tenacity, they can bring down a very, very entrenched regime. And yet, as you say, I mean, what we have now is even more direct rule by the military than it has been, at least since the mid-50s, and in fact, you know, for most of the 100 years before that and before that. So the tasks, I think, are quite difficult, particularly as right now, although the Supreme Military Council has said, well, we're implementing the demands of the public by, you know, suspending Parliament and the Constitution. You know, one of the key demands, I think, and what would be, to my mind and many people's mind, the first demand, which would be to suspend the state of emergency that's been in effect since the Sadat assassination in 1982. I mean, that has not been done. People are being cleared out of the square. There's not a menacing military presence in the street, but there are, you know, tanks at pretty much every strategic intersection and in front of, you know, important buildings and so forth. So it does take, I think, a combination of trust in the military, again, not so much the army itself, which I think most people do trust because it's so much a citizen army, but in the high command, there needs to be trust in them to work with and ultimately cede power to civilian leaders, among whom I must say that I look in particular to probably more than two groups, but the first two groups I'd name would be the judiciary, which is a very strong judiciary in Egypt. There are very committed and highly professionalized judges and also attorneys and human rights lawyers. And so the judicial community, I think, has a phenomenal role to play. And it is also my personal view, although this, I think, maybe is my personal view, that there's also a huge role for diplomats and anyone who is skilled in negotiating. And then, of course, finally, you know, probably the biggest wild card is how civil society, the social groups who have been demonstrating, can kind of constitute themselves in a much more organized way than was required to demonstrate in Tahrir, to put together probably political parties and slates of candidates and to run a successful election. And that's just, those are just the things at the top of the list.
Again, I'm speaking with Sheila Carapico, who is the chair of the Political Science Department at the American University in Cairo, where she is. And we're talking about the sort of day after, if you will, or as the dust settles. Now, your students, you mentioned your students are back in class. I think, well, first of all, I think it's somewhat, in retrospect, embarrassing to think of how the average American thought that Egypt was a kind of a democracy. I think that's fairly fair to say. And how these last 2 to 3 weeks have caught everybody by surprise and shown us in no uncertain manner how autocratic and dictatorial the regime was and how brutal the police and secret police apparatus is and how ubiquitous and how much it controlled their lives. Knowing these students now and then when they were chafing under this regime, does any of this catch you by surprise? Because, frankly, I think the world has been caught by surprise.
Well, I wouldn't probably have thought to put it exactly as you did. I mean, if Americans thought that Egypt was a democracy, then I think that was just something they were deducing from the fact that it's such a good ally of the United States. But no one familiar with the Egyptian political system would have thought of it as anything close to a democracy. And, you know, clearly Mubarak, I mean, did, I think, win a fairly legitimate election about 25 years ago, but you know, since then, the electoral system has become increasingly, I mean, bogus. What was surprising, though, I think, and what makes the youth significant, although it is not correct to say that it was a bunch of kids in Tahrir, but what makes the youth significant is that I think the older generation of Egyptians had come to think that this is the way it is and it's the only way it can be. And something sparked the imagination of people, I'd say particularly between, say, ages 20 and 30, you know, who are not children, but who somehow managed to imagine, to envision, to dream of something else, and then just to start to all congregate in the largest, you know, public space in the country and just sit there insisting that this was going to happen. And that, I think, is what took everybody by surprise, and that we are all still kind of just reeling from, you know, the unprecedented nature of such a thing.
Again, I'm speaking with Sheila Carapico, who's the chair of the Political Science Department at the American University in Cairo, where she is late in the evening, Cairo time. Now, Sheila, the real not only is democracy yet to be born in the sense of multi-party elections. The parties have been eviscerated over the years by Mubarak. And what I was meaning to say, I think, was that the average person, I think, thought of Egypt as an okay place, you know, and that nobody thought that this guy was particularly bad. Only people who knew what was going on, and frankly, we have a fairly, I think, a small political class in this country. But the long and the short of it is, we have most of the money and the power and the wealth in that country in the hands of a few of these crony oligarchs of the Mubarak regime, and you've got this situation with the military where they've been getting $60 billion from the United States since Camp David, and have essentially created a kind of their own little military-industrial complex where they all, basically have benefited from the regime. So how are you going to pry that kind of control loose, the economic monopoly and the military monopoly?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I think that's really a key question, and it's difficult to imagine. I mean, some people will be brought to justice, and again, I think the judiciary has an incredible role to play, and already at least a few people, are under investigation for corruption and also for human rights abuses, torture, and so forth. Although, parenthetically, I mean, it's, I suppose, could have been worse. I mean, it wasn't sort of Saddam Hussein level. But in any case, it is very difficult to see how, as you call it, and many people call it, the military-industrial complex, which is a huge sector in the economy. I mean, they manufacture all kinds of things, you know, cooking gas cylinders and so many things. And it is difficult to imagine that will be dismantled. And so, the question, I think, to my mind, I mean, it's very unlikely that that's just going to go away. The question is whether that can coexist with an actual civilian government, not merely, it's possible, I think, under such circumstances to envision a scenario in which, there are rather free and open elections, but that the parliament that they elect is fairly impotent. And so the key question, which cannot happen, I don't think, immediately, is whether, there will gradually be the transfer of real authority away from, the generals, the Supreme Military Council, to a civilian government, to the point that, the military comes under civilian command and civilian control. And, the model for that is probably Turkey, where the military was certainly in complete control for much longer than will happen in Egypt, but where, gradually over, a period of a couple of decades, really, it did become basically a system where the military is still a very important factor in politics, but it is true and correct to say that the government is a civilian government.
Well, of course, the analogies that have been made a lot with Turkey involve the secular versus the religious. And that's clearly been overstated, both over the years, and Mubarak has used the Muslim Brotherhood bogeyman as a way to justify his rule. But my understanding is that there was a poll done here by Middle East Institute which is, I think, a fairly pro-Israel one, suggesting that the Muslim Brotherhood was fairly insignificant and that we've yet to see the full complexion of Egyptian politics because they've been suppressed for so long. But it's by and large a fairly secular and centrist to liberal kind of country. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, I think the, I mean, what happened basically in the 80s and to some extent in the 90s, I think was, and this is true in Egypt, but also in other countries in the region, that so many forms of legitimate political participation were suppressed, that one of the few kind of refuges, not only for politics, but also for even social activism, became religious. So young people, for example, who wanted to be involved, who wanted to serve their society, found that the only place they could really do that was in their mosques or for the Christian minority through their churches. And so it almost pushed politics into a kind of hyper-religious form. And I think that that tide had already ebbed and is no longer, you know, the rising force among particularly Egyptian youth. I mean, the Brotherhood are getting kind of old, you know. They're, I mean, it's run by people who are also of Mubarak's generation or else, you know, quite close to his generation. And among the youth, I mean, there certainly is a young following for the Brotherhood. But I think it's a grave mistake to assume that those people, for example, don't want electoral politics. The other question is, of course, you know, what happens to this, to the ruling party, which has been the dominant force in which, you know, pretty much anyone who wanted to be anybody had to join the so-called National Democratic Party of Mubarak. And this presumably is going to, I mean, it's discredited and it's going to fall apart. And so, you know, that's one point. And then if I could just go back to the previous point, I'm sorry for being not linear in this. But, you know, one of the crimes that happened not that long ago was the bombing of a Coptic church. And that has now been laid at the hands of a member of the ruling National Democratic Party. And, you know, that was seen at the time as, you know, it was very frightening to Copts, and it was seen as an indication of, you know, the enduring and deep-seated religious animosities. But it turned out to have been a deliberately provocative political act. So I think that not only is the Brotherhood not quite as scary as we think of it from the 90s when they were blowing up tourist things and so forth, not the Brotherhood, but other radical Islamist groups. I mean, that's faded away quite substantially now. It's been a long time, apart from these incidents that seem to have been provocations, that anything like that has happened. But in addition, you know, there's reason to believe that under a freer political system, sure, I mean, there would be religious conservatives. There are, and there are, frankly, in our country as well. But, you know, they're part of the body politic, and they get to vote and have representation in parliament and then, you know, slug it out with other groups in society who include liberals and, for that matter, a certain number of social democrats and, you know, libertarian types. I mean, you know, there's a very wide political spectrum in Egypt.
Well, just in closing, Sheila Karapika, you're describing the NDC as a there's so many of those kind of Cold War creations that ruled in Italy and in the Liberal Democratic Party in Japan, the PRI party in Mexico, and arguably the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. There are certain similarities there. But when you mentioned earlier the judiciary, the sort of awakening judiciary, which you characterize as being very professional, and the possibility of torture trials, what about Omar Suleiman? Isn't he Mr. Torture?
Well, I mean, he is. I've certainly seen that label. And yes, I think it is quite possible. I mean, again, one major question is, you know, how many trials will they be and how far will they go? And, you know, will they concentrate at the top, which is where I believe they should be, you know, or at the guys in the police station who killed that poor young guy, Khalid Said, back in October or something like that. So, yeah, Suleiman and other leading members of the now deposed regime may indeed have to stand trial for their crimes.
Well, I thank you for joining us and for giving us a kind of an appraisal of the day after here. And let's stay in touch. It's been a pleasure talking to you, and I'm glad that we were able to do this kind of bookend from the beginning to the end with you, Sheila Carapico.
Great. Let's hope it's a new day and a good day.
Thank you again. Again, I was speaking with Sheila Carapico, who's the chair of the Political Science Department at the American University in Cairo, where she researches the political economy of development with special emphasis on Arab countries. She's the author of Civil Society in Yemen, The Political Economy of Activism in Modern Arabia, and her forthcoming book is titled Political Aid, Democracy Promotion and the Paradoxes of Empowerment. She's also a contributing editor to Middle East Report. Let's now take a brief station break. And welcome back to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'm speaking with Charles Schmitz, who is the president of the American Institute of Yemeni Studies. He is a professor of geography at Towson University and has researched and written extensively on Yemen and its relationship with other nations on the Arabian Peninsula and with the United States. Thank you so much for joining us on Background Briefing, Charles Schmitz.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
And clearly, these young protesters in Yemen, they squared off against the security forces on Sunday, and some of them marched on the presidential palace in Sana'a. This represents the third day of demonstrations, and I think fairly clearly they're emulating their brethren in Egypt, but in considerably fewer numbers, right?
Yeah, no, it's not nearly as large as in Egypt, no.
But they are using text messages and other social media to organize, right?
Yeah, I wouldn't. I saw a protester with a sign for Facebook, but I wouldn't say that that is the most important or nearly as important maybe as in Egypt. I don't know how important it really was in Egypt. In Yemen, the demonstrations are really being organized by the opposition. There is some spontaneous demonstration going on, but most of it is being driven by the legal political opposition in Yemen.
So there have been reports, though, that the young people demonstrating here are in the way that in Egypt the opposition, for what it was pretty much sidelined. And you're saying no, that the opposition is not being sidelined here.
No, the opposition is playing a key role. There is some rejection of politics as normal. There are in the South, in particular, there were a couple of people who burned effigies of all the large the main political actors in Yemen, calling them all dinosaurs, and saying that the only person that has legitimacy in the Arab world is the guy in Tunisia who burned himself. But largely the events in Yemen are being channeled through the opposition. The opposition was somewhat sidelined. I mean, the Yemeni opposition has been sidelined since about 2006, when a large-scale rebellion broke out in the south and an armed rebellion broke out in the north. And the Yemeni opposition, having put on a very effective electoral campaign where they got almost a third of the vote, then sort of faded to the background. In fact, these protests have energized the opposition again, and they thus far seem to be doing a pretty good job of rebuilding their forces and organizing. The demonstrations, I think, that we saw in front of the presidential palace, some of the human rights organizations were behind that. And so there is some spontaneousness, but it's being channeled through an existing political opposition in Yemen.
And again, I'm speaking with Charles Schmitz, who's the president of the American Institute of Yemeni Studies. We're talking about the possibility of the contagion of democracy spreading as it has from Tunisia to Egypt and then to Yemen. There are, of course, some analogies. the president has been around as long as Mubarak, three decades. The demonstrators also were in Yemen, were in Tahrir Square, so they have their, but obviously the scale is incredibly different here. The difference, I suppose, though, is that given that these young Egyptians were up against some of these police thugs and who were armed, I take it that Yemen is a country with a well-armed populace, arguably the kind of NRA's idea of a country.
Yeah. A couple of things. I mean, there is a large-scale demonstration. I'm not sure it's the scale. It's the sort of the context in which the demonstrations are happening are slightly different, I think, in Yemen. Yemen, there is the political security forces. They are thugs, like in Egypt. Maybe not quite as effective. A little bit more random in Yemen than they are in Egypt. They do have those, and in the demonstrations that we're seeing in the main cities, those would be unarmed people. Though Yemenis are well armed, they're aware of the of armed struggle, of armed conflict breaking out, and so they tend to not use arms. The example is the Southern Movement. They've declared that theirs is a peaceful movement for succession, and they've consciously tried to avoid conflicts with the state security apparatus and with the military. So, in that sense, it's somewhat the same as Egypt. But I would say a couple of things. There are similarities. There are similarities in that there's a large youth cohort in Yemen that's frustrated economically. The Yemeni economy is not doing well. And then on top of it, there's kind of an old political guard. And the old political guard over the last, like, 5 years has really been fighting it out over the question of succession. The president was trying to position his son to become the ruler of Yemen, and within the core of the ruling elite, there was strong opposition to it. And so the last 4 or 5 years, the elite of Yemen have been sort of battling it out amongst themselves at the expense of the entire country, really. Allowing open military conflicts, allowing the economy to kind of go to pots. Oil revenues are declining. They haven't done much about it. They're trying to do some stuff now. They haven't done much about it. And they seem to have stopped recently. And then just before all this broke out in Tunisia, the president, who is elected in a direct presidential election and whose second term and last term constitutionally will be up in 2013, he put proposals before Parliament saying that he would get rid of those limits. They were merely proposals before Parliament, put on the floor of Parliament. Then the Yemeni opposition walked out of Parliament. It's a minority in Parliament. The ruling party could have put those on the table and discussed them, but it didn't. It didn't have time to. And then when all these demonstrations broke out, the president withdrew the proposals. So he has said that he will not run in 2013, he will not try and amend the Constitution, and significantly he won't put his son forward. It's sort of a concession, but he only made those proposals a couple of weeks ago, so it's not that big of a concession.
Well, sure. Charles Schmitz, again, the president of the American Institute of Yemeni Studies, there's echoes there, Mubarak with his son Gamal. Let's talk about America's role and how what kind of influence America has in that country, and whether it's similar to, for example, Afghanistan, where our policy has largely been taken over by the military, and we have these former generals now as diplomats. Who's in charge in terms of the American account, if you will? Because my understanding is, and particularly from the WikiLeaks documents, which indicated that the Saleh, the president, was basically our guy in terms of the military, and that I think those WikiLeaks revelations did hurt President Saleh. But who's running the show there in terms of our side of the coin?
Yeah, that's a, I mean, I don't know exactly who's running it, but security issues dominate the agenda, the American agenda in Yemen. And so, I mean, even if, you know, the White House is running it, it's the security concerns that are the priority. And so the military guys really have the greatest weight in the policies on Yemen. We don't, it's not like Egypt where we support directly the military itself. We mostly support anti-terror, specifically anti-terror units in Yemen. But our and our economic support is not that big. But we play a very, very important sort of leading role in international relations with Yemen. And so American support, though it's small in monetary terms, politically it's very important for the president. And I would say that we have tremendous influence in the country. I think the key event was Obama backing the demonstrators in Egypt. I think when he did that, he gave Ali Abdullah Saleh a great scare. The president went before Parliament. He called a joint session of all the legislative branches together and gave a speech in which he renounced his proposals that he had put forward that were going to extend his rule. Following that, he got a call from Obama supporting his move. He did what Obama wanted, and Obama's call was very important for him, I think, politically. The danger that the Americans, the emphasis that the Americans put on security, is that it alienates much of the Yemeni population, for whom the big issues are sort of true sort of democracy, true sort of political liberalization, and bigger than that, the economy. That's the big one. Yemen is a quite poor country, poorer than Egypt, and right now the economic prospects are very bleak. And so the country really needs smart political leadership to get it through this tough economic time. And at the moment, there's nothing happening. And so there is a lot of tension for change in Yemen, and the Americans focusing on the military is somewhat delegitimizing. The State Department has been trying to move, become more involved in sort of development issues, and USAID has a huge project now that it's trying to put in place in Yemen. But it's going to be a while before any of that has any effect on the economy. And so, for Yemeni eyes, the United States supporting the military stuff, it looks like we've got our eyes on the wrong ball, that, we're not interested in Yemenis, we're only interested in al-Qaeda, and that's it.
And we're playing this game of balancing democratic reforms against stability, and you're suggesting, Charles Schmitz, that the stability side dominates as opposed to the kind of Peace Corps side, if you will. And given the analogies with Egypt, the young people, I imagine, have even bleaker employment prospects in Yemen since the main source of income for the country, oil, is supposed to dry up in a decade.
Yes, that's right. Yes, they're facing a very tough economic future. And unlike in the past, the state really has to manage the Yemen economy. The Yemen economy has to become much more diversified, and it needs smart, effective management. And the state has basically been resting on oil revenues, and it hasn't built institutional capabilities to sort of manage the country, the economy, collect taxes, these sorts of things. So it's making the situation worse, and people are aware of that. People know that's the case.
So this is a country already beset by a secession movement in the south and a rebellion in the north. And we're obsessed with al-Qaeda. I suppose it's worth noting that bin Laden's family are Yemenis, right?
A long time ago. They're Saudis.
They're Saudis, but they come from Yemen, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And what's the since you've worked there and spent a lot of time there, Charles Smith, what's your sense of bin Laden's appeal? Because we seem to be focused on this radical U.S.-born cleric, Anwar al-Awlaki.
Yeah. My impression is that Yemenis are much more focused on political reform and economic development. The only place where you really see support, and it's not really support, it's rather defense of civil rights. In other words, what Yemenis are concerned about is that they're very concerned that the Americans are going to do things which are not in the interest of civil rights, that they will, for example, condone targeted killings and in extrajudicial holding of people simply in the name of the fight against al-Qaeda. They're very concerned about that. For example, when the two packages that were found on the airplanes that came from Yemen, when the security picked up the woman whose card had been used to mail those things, they were protesting, and the protests were saying, judicial due process, that they were worried that she would be tortured or she would be, held without due process, without a lawyer, et cetera, simply because the Americans wanted it. And this is the concern. This is where you will see them not defending al-Qaeda, but worried about what sort of support the United States is going to give to the regime, whether it's going to support, autocratic measures, repressive measures, simply in the name of fighting al-Qaeda.
So just in the last minute or so, Charles Schmitz, what's your sense of whether this idea of these dominoes is overstated? I mean, we've got clearly analogies with this regime, which we which we've discussed. And sorry, I've got a terrible cold, but we've discussed these analogies with the Mubarak and the Salah and the Sun and Tahrir Square and the young people demonstrating. And there are also, similarities between the Syrian regime and the Egyptian regime. There are similarities with Gaddafi's regime, military dictatorship in effect, which is what Egypt is now and always has been, at least since the colonial times. So in that kind of broader context, where would you place Yemen as a potential domino if the contagion of democracy spread throughout the Middle East?
Well, there's no doubt that Ali Abdullah Saleh is weak and that there is a potential for him to go. I would say that a more likely scenario now, though, is that that the opposition will reconvene in parliament, it will be greatly strengthened, that it will be able to hold parliamentary elections, which have been held up because of political infighting, probably in the fall, and that in 2013 we may see a very real electoral campaign for the next leadership of Yemen. That very much may be the case. In other words, we might see in Yemen a true transition, not one where the autocratic leaves, but actually when it steps down and there's elections for future leadership. That would actually be quite wide open, because Yemen is quite fractured in its politics, and there may be a very different coalition coming to power in 2013. That would be a good scenario.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today in Los Angeles, Charles Schmitz.
You're welcome.
Again, I'm speaking with Charles Schmitz, who's the president of the American Institute for Yemeni Studies. Dr. Schmitz is a professor of geography at Towson University and has researched and written extensively on Yemen and its relationship with other countries on the Arabian Peninsula as well as the United States. Let's now take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment talking with NPR's Deborah Amos, who is in Saudi Arabia. She covers the Middle East for National Public Radio and did a very prescient broadcast back in November featuring Egyptian youth using social media to push for political change. And welcome back to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'm speaking with Deborah Amos, who covers the Middle East for National Public Radio News. She has also worked as a reporter for ABC and for the PBS program Now with Bill Moyers and Frontline. She's the author of Eclipse of the Sun of the Sunnis, Power, Exile, and Upheaval in the Middle East, and Lines in the Sand, Desert Storm, and the Remaking of the Arab World. Last fall, she produced a series for PRI's America Abroad Media and NPR that focused on youth in the Arab world. One of those segments, a prescient program called Words and Deeds, Freedom of Expression and Arab Youth, told the stories of Egyptian young people who are using social media to push for political change. She joins us from Saudi Arabia. Welcome to Background Briefing, Deborah Amos.
Thank you very much for having me.
And please excuse my terrible cold, but you're there in Saudi Arabia, which Is Saudi Arabia becoming the rest home for dictators and deposed potentates?
Well, it has been in the past. They have given a welcome to Hosni Mubarak. If he wants to come here, he can. This is something that Saudi does. It's Arab hospitality. King Abdullah and Hosni Mubarak are close personal friends. But I think that the former president of Egypt has made it very clear that he wants to die on the soil of Egypt. And he is in Sharm el-Sheikh, his resort home on the beach, and the army is protecting him. And my guess is that he will stay there.
And in terms of the contagion of democracy spreading throughout the Middle East, there were reports of young people rioting in Jeddah recently, but I believe that was more to do with how the government responded to floods than political activism. Is that in terms of what's happening in Egypt and what happened earlier in Tunisia?
That's very true. And I think rioting, even so, is overstating it. There was a bit of a protest. There was a woman who challenged the governor there because the government response had been not only bad to these damaging floods, but this was the second time it had happened. And the underlying problem about these floods is that, you know, Americans will understand this, the wetlands have been sold. It is because of corruption. And there are people who are responsible because of these floods. And the people who are responsible, who bought that land, that has gotten out on the web. You know, there is a social media community here. They know those people in Cairo. They've been to workshops with them. They're on first-name basis. And, you know, the night that Hosni Mubarak resigned, I called up one of these young men, and he said, "We won." And I was touched by it because I think he really meant it. I think that this is seen, certainly in Saudi Arabia, as a generational fight in Egypt, and they do feel part of it. Each one of these countries, of course, has a different system. You were just talking about Yemen. It is different here. This is a very wealthy government, and you do see some limited protests, but I think you won't see what we saw in Egypt and Saudi Arabia.
Well, Deborah Amos, let's turn to the piece that you did, Words and Deeds, Freedom of Expression and Arab Youth. Now, it was preceded in as much it was broadcast back in November, and I believe you would have done it in September, October? Was that when you put it together?
No, actually, we were there in July. We were there before the elections. I was on the street with the April 6th movement over the summer. And the people that we interviewed ended up being the leaders on Tahrir Square. They had a very tight community. Again, they all knew each other. They had tried their best to speak out in a very clamped down system that only got worse after the elections in the fall. The regime essentially stole those elections. And I wondered even at the time, why was it so necessary to be so brutal about stealing that election? What were they afraid of? And I think what we saw on the square is we know exactly what they were afraid of, that there was this boiling anger in the country. Labor organizations had been demonstrating for a while. They had teamed up with some of the young student social activists. And so this was a movement that was building. I don't know. I certainly didn't know it. I think they didn't know it. They didn't know it until the website went up that was called January 25th hashtag, put up by a young Google executive. And it was a call for action on what in Egypt is Police Day. I think he was surprised, certainly after he was held for 12 days and when he made his first comments on the air, he was surprised at the extent of the response. So I think it took everybody by surprise.
I must say, Deborah Amos, I spoke to a 17-year-old young woman, a reporter with Youth Journalism International in Alexandria, and she spoke so glowingly about that Google executive, saying he was an exemplar of all that the young Egyptians wanted, that he had a good job, he had a place in, I believe, in Abu Dhabi or somewhere in the Gulf, and that he was a truly honorable and somebody to emulate. It was very, very quite touching.
I bet. And, you know, what he did was he was all over the Gulf and running workshops. They were in Qatar. Some of the Saudis that I've met know him quite well because they had a chance to meet each other. No government thought that there was anything wrong with that. They were all going to talk about the web. What could be wrong with that? And so he, when he was taken, that really was a sign, I think, for everybody who's been blogging, you know, these under 30s who spend their evenings, if they're lucky enough to have a job in the day, and what they are is that they're on the internet for 5 to 10 hours in the night. And he is a symbol for them, and I think he will remain a symbol for them.
So when you were doing this piece well before the recent eruption, and it was, as I say, it was broadcast back in November, I listened to it, and it was quite touching in many ways. To obviously, in retrospect, you felt some of the pain of these people, that they were so alone, that they didn't really – I think it's true to fair to say that the average American thought that Egypt was okay and Mubarak was okay. I don't think anybody – except for our rather small political class, had any concept of the systematic and brutality of the apparatus of repression in Egypt.
You know, part of the reason that we launched that series is there has been a lot of research recently, think tanks in Washington, think tanks in the Gulf, that have become quite interested in the youth bulge. This is a region where 60% of the population is under 30. Those numbers are even more stark here in Saudi Arabia. 80% of the population is under 40. 70% is under 30. And all kinds of things were happening in society because of this huge youth bulge. I mean, think about, I'm certainly part of the baby boom. That was our youth bulge. We were activists, and politics were hot when there was a lot of us. And I think that it was known by researchers that this could also possibly happen with this particular demographic, in particular because a couple of things were happening to them. One, it was very hard for them to get jobs. The more educated you were, the more likely you did not have a job. The age of marriage was climbing, 32 in Egypt, because it was just too expensive for young people to get married. And when we were there this summer, it was so clear that you're right, they did feel alone. They felt oppressed. The government was after them. You know, this movement started in 2005 in Egypt. And in the beginning, the government didn't know how to respond to them, but they certainly did learn how to respond. And some of these kids were arrested and tortured. They were harassed by the police. You know, every once in a while, somebody would get taken, and you thought, where is this going? And then, as I said, the elections came, and it got even worse. And so, I'm really grateful that I met them all back then, and in some funny way, proud as I watched all of them stick it out on Tahrir Square.
Again, I'm speaking with Deborah Amos, who covers the Middle East for National Public Radio, and she produced a series, Words and Deeds, Freedom of Expression and Arab Youth, which was broadcast back in November. As she mentioned, she started doing it in the last summer, and it profiles the very people that we've seen as the progenitors of this revolution in Tahrir Square, the social network organizers, and also she profiled Morocco and Syria, which I think is also interesting in the sense that, well, actually, even we were talking earlier about Yemen, there's so many similarities. Salah has been in for 3 decades. He tried to put his son in there, as Mubarak did. And you've got this inherited autocracy there operating in Syria. When you'd mentioned a minute ago, Deborah Amos, the idea of the 60s activism being a baby boomer, obviously it's often been argued that New Age awareness happens at the expense of political action, and it's so clear that the regime in Syria very cleverly decided to make the personal more important than the political.
You know, however, let me tell you an interesting phenomenon. A friend of mine, an economist, wrote a piece on a Syrian website that, you know, if Syria didn't wise up, they were going to go the way of Egypt. They have the same problems, an overeducated youth population that does not have jobs, over 3% population growth. And the numbers were all ripe for the same kind of discontent that even Syria, probably the most repressive of the regimes in the region. Even Syria would not be able to contain. And a day after that piece appeared on the web, the Minister of Health announced that they were going to start a birth control program in Damascus. So, you know, you don't have a situation where Bashar al-Assad said that his son wouldn't be president, but they have taken measures. For the first time ever, Syria has lifted the ban on Facebook and Twitter in the country. Not that anybody was paying much attention to it, because they could all, you know, hook their phones up to Lebanon and got on Facebook, and they all did. But, you know, even Syria understands that it is now time, you know, to show a little leg, that there has to be some response from the government to this overwhelming reaction in Cairo. Something else happened today that actually made me smile. If you remember the program, the long version of the program we did, we start out with some hip-hop kids in a Cairo apartment named the Arabian Nights, and they have put out sort of an anthem of Tahrir Square. It's called January 25th, hashtag. And I got a call from a Saudi in Jeddah, and he's been playing it. He runs a hip-hop online site, radio station, because you couldn't do this on government radio. And they've been playing it all day long. That has become the song of this generation.
Well, Deborah Amos, the segment that you did on Syria, though, I was interested in Hani al-Sayed, the radio host of Good Morning Syria, and the extent to which she made it really clear that, in effect, they've encouraged personal conversations, often about social subjects that have been previously taboo. But everybody also understood, and there's apparently a sort of nascent free, commercial media there. But everybody knows where the line is that you do not cross. You just don't talk about politics. And do you think that model is going to work? It's obviously the model that operates in Saudi Arabia. How long can you compartmentalize those things? The Chinese regime does this similarly as well.
Well, I have to say, and I've been surprised by this, that there is more freedom of speech in Saudi Arabia than there is in Syria. There's a great deal going on, in not so much in the newspapers, but certainly online. You know, what the social media kids here are allowed to write about in their blogs, without apparent consequence. There is an unofficial human rights group, and they've been calling for the arrest of the Minister of the Interior, and they've been doing it consistently online. They get themselves shut down, on the web, and this, their website is now called, you know, the Human Rights Group number 14, because they keep changing the name every time they get shut down. But I'm surprised to say, that it is more open here. I don't know how long the Syrians, actually can do that. There is a population, that does want change. It's a small part of the population. It's a very depoliticized generation in Syria. They want to get rich. You know, they are squeezed between the chaos of Lebanon and the chaos of Iraq, and they're interested in making money. If Bashar can open up the economy fast enough, and that is a huge if, he can be ahead of the curve by doing some reforms little by little. But there are two countries that if we saw a youth revolution would really change the Middle East, and one of them is Syria, and one of them is here in Saudi Arabia.
And what was interesting about the piece on Syria was, of course, that some of the experts, like Rami Khoury, clearly got it wrong, in as much as they said that social media would never make a difference. But the obviously, in the analysis of Egypt, which continues, the influence of the Muslim Brotherhood has been overstated. But you can't overstate the influence of the Mudawakin in Saudi Arabia and the Wahhabi religious police, surely. So how do these young kids navigate that? Because my understanding is an awful amount of frustration in their lives that they can't date. They have the technological means to communicate, but physically they can't do much.
Well, you'll be surprised to know that the Mutawa, the religious police, have been taking sensitivity training here. I was here in 2005. The changes are remarkable. I have not worn a headscarf since I've been here, and nobody has bothered me about that. I've been in the malls. I've been in restaurants. I see people dating. I can see them in the restaurants. They are in the family sections, and without the Mutawa bugging them, there are some things that people can do here that they've never been able to do before. They can meet online. It used to be that you'd throw your cell phone number at a girl in the mall. Now you can Facebook her, and you can talk to her, and you can arrange a meeting. And that does happen here. For the first time ever, Facebook has allowed Saudis to meet outside of their family in what even their parents consider a safe environment. Yes, there is frustration, and the frustration is about jobs. Jobs here is a huge, huge issue. You have 10% unemployment, 44% among college grads. At the same time, you have an economy that last year produced 800,000 jobs, but that was for expats. And this country has an open policy of allowing foreigners to come here and work because they work cheaper than the Saudis. But this cannot go on forever. The king, Abdullah, is a reformer. He's done more to allow women to move ahead in the society than any king in my memory. The system here works on consensus. There are people who push back and push back hard. And so I think his moves are slower than he would like. But the country is, I am remarkably surprised from having been away for 5 years, what I'm seeing here.
Well, Deborah Amos, I thank you so much for joining us. It's been really interesting to get this comprehensive look at the region that you cover for NPR. I appreciate it. Again, I've been speaking with Deborah Amos, who covers the Middle East for National Public Radio News. She's also worked as reporter for ABC and for the PBS program Now with Bill Moyers and Frontline. She's the author of Eclipse of the Sunnis, Power, Exile, and Upheaval in the Middle East, and Lines in the Sand, Dress, Desert Storm, and the Remaking of the Arab World. Last fall, she produced a series for PRI's America Abroad Media and NPR that focused on the youth in the Arab world, and she told stories of the Egyptian young people who are using social media to push for political change. I'd like to invite you all this coming Thursday, 7 p.m., to the Hammer Museum in Westwood, where I'll be hosting a forum, Cuba After the Castros, with a journalist and former revolutionary colleague of Fidel Castro, Max Lesnik, and Castro biographer Ann Louise Bardek. So it's free and open to the public. Please do come on next Thursday at 7 in Westwood, the Hammer Museum. I'd also like to ask any of our young volunteers out there who know how to work the net, which we don't do very well, to help us out here. We desperately need interns to help us with our net at ianmasters.com, where we are trying to build a website, and we'd appreciate any help. You can always get contact us through ianmasters.com. I'd like to thank Spencer Downing, the engineer, and Devin Jordan, the engineer, and Spencer Downing, the producer, without whom we would not have a program here. Thank you. Bye.